Welcome to Living in the Matrix. I'm Jonathan, and I'm left of center.
And I'm Rich, and I tend to lean a little bit more to the right. But the bottom line is together we try to look for the balance of what it means to be human in today's world.
So welcome, everybody. This is Living in the Matrix. I'm Jonathan. This is my co-host, Rich. Say hello, Rich.
Hey, everybody. Great to be back. Looking forward to this episode in particular because we're starting to see people outside the matrix who have broken through in more of a financial thing, something you'll see more on LinkedIn. Last year when we started, we had a lot of people help out with depression, diet, you know, ice baths. And now we've seen over the last couple of months, more of a, we've had a CEO from Austin, Christopher, who helps with a health app that has like coaching for the health style things.
That's
so I'm
great.
Really thrilled to dive into this career tech money journey and dive in. Excited for the podcast, Jonathan.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I think Rich did a really good job, Christopher, that we want to touch on, but just to give our audience a little bit of understanding, Christopher comes from a consulting background and really rose through the ranks, did a bunch of startups and actually got to exit on some IPOs. And part of what attracted us to him is his understanding of the journey, especially through the concept of the matrix. So this turned out to be an absolutely barn burner for us. We are so looking forward to this. Welcome, Christopher.
Thank you so much. I am so excited to be here and to, you know, be sharing with people who realize there is a matrix. There is this framework and this structure that if we don't ask questions, if we don't stay curious, if we aren't persistent with our whys, we can stay trapped inside for our entire lives. And I love having conversations like this. So let's get into it.
So I'm going to ask you the first question. You brought it up.
Okay.
From your perspective, and we asked this of a couple guests recently, what is your perspective of what is the matrix? Because it's obviously not some mental metal machine. What is it? What do you think it is?
Well, I think it's two things. To me, the matrix is two dimensions. There's societal norms. When you live here in the United States, there is a societal norm of the way that you should really craft your life. You know, so you want to go, you want to do good in primary school, you want to do good in high school, maybe play some sports or music, you know, you diversify your interests, then you go to college, then you work, then you have kids, right? Everybody knows there's this formula. And the other dimension I think that locks us in is comfort, right? Is once we get in there and if you go through and you progress, number one, you're going to feel very comfortable because you're going to get a lot of attaboys. You're going to get a lot of attagirls. You're going to get a lot of confirmation and affirmation. And then you're going to get onto this treadmill that is work and you're going to start getting money, getting compensation. It's going to start giving you things. Oh, now it's giving me a couch. It's giving me a large television. It's giving me all these comforts. If we're not careful, what I found is that people get sucked into the comfort. They get sucked into consuming. They lose the desire to create. They lose imagination because they want to please people. And the thing is this doesn't always come out of harm. It comes out of people who are themselves in this matrix, wanting to do the right thing, wanting to see you kept safe, wanting to see you do the right thing. But ultimately, I think it leads to people being trapped, people feeling depressed, disenfranchised. I know myself, when I did what everybody told me and I got to the pinnacle and I became a CIO, a chief information officer, I felt incredibly trapped. I felt depressed. I felt like this wasn't where I wanted to be. But the reality is I did what everybody told me to do, and boom, matrix.
So, go ahead, Rich. I'll let you go.
What was the red pill moment then, right? So Neo goes through his day-to-day life. He's this respectable software program, works for a respectable software company. Even the guy who brings him into the office, I guess for being late, looks a little bit like Mr. Smith, right? Agent Smith. So I guess the question for you is, we know that Neo kept having these weird dreams. He had something bugging him in the back of his mind. What was that for you? As sort of like an existential feeling of depression. What was the red pill moment for you there, Christopher?
I think the red pill moment was when I realized like this was like there was a moment that I had, you call it a moment of clarity, call it divine inspiration, where I realized like this wasn't the life that was meant for me. It was, I had this moment and I realized like I had this job and it was a job that many people would ultimately covet, right? Because you work so hard. It was working on One Madison Avenue, heart of New York City. And I realized this was not giving me the deep happiness and fulfillment that I wanted to. In fact, it was keeping me away from my young family, working a lot of hours. And I realized for all of the desire, all of the negotiation to get to that position, I had to walk away, or I was just going to suffer in silence. And ultimately I just couldn't do that. It was literally a breaking point.
What made you walk away? Because it sounds like you obviously did at some
point. Yeah, no, I did. And it was, you know, I was only into the role like 9 months, and it was literally
was this at Yext?
Yes, it was. It was at Yext. And what it was is it was, I didn't like, I think part of it is there was a couple things. There was a couple dimensions, but I mean, I think the biggest one is I did not understand how to get fulfillment in my job and how to get fulfillment in my life. Mm-hmm. Right. I had up until that point, my job and my vocation had brought me so much joy. My family had brought me joy, but then I moved this rung up the ladder and I felt like I was miserable here and I was miserable there. So the interesting thing is I knew, I always had a vision of what, you know, great looked like how I wanted to work. I just knew that it wasn't that. And I think it was finding your voice and realizing it's okay to unwind everything. It's okay. You know, I knew that I believed in myself. I believed in my skill set. I had a few things in place that I knew that while I would take, you know, some knocks walking away from there, I knew I could figure out what was next.
What did everybody around you say? Because I think that's what a lot of people feel, what you feel, but don't want to disappoint people or not be able to take care of the things that you've grown accustomed to taking care of. What was that like for you?
Well, so I actually had a track record of that. So it was like I had an understanding of how to be a maverick, because when I left high school to go to college, and after 2 years, I realized I wasn't ready for college. I wanted to explore the world, and I got up and I left. You know, I was going to UC San Diego at the time. I left in good standing and I went to go travel around Europe and bartend and see the world. And at that point, that was a major freak out. So I think when I got to that point in my life, you know, I think it is important when everybody gets that moment that they step outside the matrix and people freak out. And then if you come back, not that you're coming back into the matrix, but you're coming back to re-engage and you're doing something that people see. You know, I came back and finished my degree, computer science. I started pursuing a career. And even at that point, I made the decision not to get married right away. I wanted to stay single for a while and see the world some more and explore it in that direction. But people started getting comfortable that, oh, he's navigating well in the world. It's not like he's not taking care of himself. So I say that because when you flex that muscle once to do it again, it's still hard. And I think my family, the great news was my family knew he's going to be fine. This is sort of his thing. There was definitely, I think, the, you know, the corporate world, it was a, oh, wow, everybody was taking a breath, like, whoa, what just happened? Was it, you know, was it a meltdown? Is this guy okay? And there was definitely a lot of question marks, you know, from that perspective. At the same time, I think that when you start getting honest with people and say, you know what, I don't think that role is right for me. I went on in my career and made the decision to take a step down where I could really be working with my team, making an impact and not, you know, in the ether, doing all the political stuff. That served me a lot better.
But I was going to say, you spent a lot of time at Accenture, and when you think about, you know, massive consulting firms, I worked with Accenture. They were a client of LinkedIn, with an organization. It was a tool called Elevate, which it was an employee advocacy platform where, you know, obviously you can imagine all the intellectual property and all the great content. Accenture thrives on knowledge. It's yes. Little digital kind of knowledge and transformational things. So the more you send that out there vis-a-vis your network, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, the more reach that Accenture gets. And yet at the same time, when you ask somebody, you know, what's the difference between a car salesman and a consultant? The answer is the car salesman knows when he's ripping you off. There's some different kinds of baggage that comes with the consulting world. So yeah. It looks like you did a lot of SaaS work there, which is really cool. Software as a service back then was kind of these new kind of ARR kind of revenue model. Tell me what was some of the things that you learned at Accenture that really kind of helped form, you know, your trajectory here. I mean, because it was probably informative. Was it not a helpful experience at Accenture? Oh,
incredibly informative. It was It was an on-the-job MBA. And as I tell everyone, you know, because I think consulting is, you know, does have its challenges. I'm not trying to say it's perfect, but for myself, it was literally the special forces of business where they're going to drop you into very challenging situations and you need to assess the situation. You need to get up to speed quickly and you have to move forward. And that coming out of school where I realized that I loved technology and I wanted to work with technology that sat at the intersection of business. You know, when you work and you're implementing, you know, and I was working on traditional ERPs and CRMs, you get that. And then I saw the transformative opportunity of SaaS, and I had the chance to be a part of that early. And when you're in consulting and you're able to be a part of leading edge technology, that's when things are absolutely amazing. And you can live it's nice because you get the opportunity to advance your career, but then you can also be flown around the world because you're this expert and they want to get you in front of clients. And what are the things you learn? You learn to, you know, think on your feet. You learn to present to executives. You learn to have that boardroom presence, that boardroom speak. You learn how to put together a presentation on the fly that's concise, that's very crisp. You have to come up with business cases. And ultimately, you do, if you want to be on, you know, I think if you want to be a part of a consulting group that is growing and having, you know, good business, you have to consistently deliver value. And I do believe that Accenture, you know, when I was there, just crafted great people. And so you were surrounded with all this high talent all the time. So it was very, intoxicating, and it was cool to be a part of.
Yeah, it's amazing to work with really smart people. It really is. It's kind of like you wish everybody could have an experience like that once in their life, because things hum. They move quickly because there's not a lot of bureaucracy in really intelligent organizations. And so that sounds like it was a wildly good experience for you and helped you begin this idea of crafting a journey in your career, which is what you really focus on. So what came out of that? Because I read an article you posted couple days ago or today on reacting to your journey. You said, I spent 8 years at a consulting firm absorbing the essence of great company cultures. How did that play into that?
Well, how it played into that is I had the opportunity to go into all these different companies, and you got to see what was working well, what wasn't working, maybe what was working at a macro level, what was working at a micro level. And so I took that knowledge, and one of the things that was that I really enjoyed about Accenture, and especially when I learned two pivotal things. Number one is when you have exceptional skills in an area where they need talent. And at that point, I became one of the first Salesforce.com technical architects in 2007.
Wow.
You get the opportunity to call your shots. And so you can say, oh, yes, I am going to take the assignment. I'm going to go live in Tokyo. I'm going to go be flying, you know, Hong Kong, Tokyo, all that stuff, living over in Asia. I'm going to make that decision. Oh, you know, I'm getting a little burnout. I'm going to take a little break here. I'm going to come back. And everyone will support you. Everyone wants to help you move forward because they see you as a valuable talent. And that gave me this vision that, okay, if I have this talent, I can actually now take this same strategy of leveraging, you know, deep skills and high execute in an area to go help tech companies go public and help create teams around their SaaS applications. At that point, Salesforce was also, you know, then all of a sudden you had NetSuite, you had Workday, you have MuleSoft, stitching them all together. You had this sort of cloud first business applications. What if I did that? And then instead of wanting so much flexibility, I actually went and traded that for equity. Because I thought, can I actually go now and take my talent, trade it for equity, and start building a portfolio that then can ultimately give me the lifestyle that I want? That was truly that time between 2009, a failed startup in 2010, that then I started putting a lot of this stuff together that I continue to teach today.
Boy, 2010, talk about, I mean, all of us went through that, right? I've been, you know, yeah. I've been selling for 30 years, so I've seen multiple recessions and or downward sales cycles, right? And you just got to navigate it. But I'd love to hear maybe a specific example or two of how you're helping people trade equity instead of like remuneration. Is that what you mean? Like instead of like paying like an XYZ and getting a little bit of equity, you're getting mostly equity. Can you flesh that out a little bit for the audience?
No, what it's actually... No, it's actually straight down the middle in the sense of people. What I've come to understand is technology employees, they think like the majority of people in the matrix, like this is sort of that outside of the matrix thinking is when we go to work for technology companies, not just startups, but when you think about even some of the Magnificent Seven, FANG, whatever you want to call these companies, you as part of your compensation are going to get salary, bonus, and equity.
Yep.
And if you position yourself as rare and valuable, you can continue to take more of that off the table. Now, if you just were a manager, senior manager at one of those big seven or even a CrowdStrike, Salesforce.com, you're going to make on average 35% more in total compensation than people who don't work for equity. And you can imagine if you are able to then take that additional 35% and instead of spending it, you go and invest that, you can accelerate your time to financial independence.
Yeah.
Now, if you're strategic, and this is the concept that came to me when I had a failed startup in 2010 and I left Accenture and it was my first trade of time and talent for equity, but I led with my heart and I didn't lead with my head. And so that led to this big failure where I spent a lot of time looking at people on LinkedIn who had, you know, worked for Google IPO, then they went to work for Netflix. And I literally would DM them and get on the phone with them and say, what are you doing? How did you figure out that these are the right companies to work for? And the net is they thought like investors with their time and talent, which means what? Which means the exchange is this. Technology companies, they want to hire and retain the best talent, and they're willing to give equity to do it. And so then you need to, on the other side, you need to position yourself as a rare and valuable asset. And I'm not just saying positioning from just marketing speak, like you got to, you know, be able to produce. But if you're able to then put your career and be a rare and valuable asset, you can trade for more equity at the right companies. And it goes a level deeper. Like you can go deeper down the rabbit hole, if you will. Mm-hmm. Meaning, so for example, I took my career where I had the experience of early on, I had to do some Sarbanes-Oxley or SOX implementations mm-hmm. on business applications for large telecom companies. I combined that with my SaaS experience and I packaged myself as a business applications leader that can help you get through SOX. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? It means that when I'm looking at opportunities, when I position myself that way, I'm not then just looking at early stage startups. I'm going to be looking at the opportunities I want to look at, which are companies that are 18 to 24 months from an IPO. Then I think like an investor and I go through a due diligence process. I do back channel validations. I look at the product. I talk to customers and I then figure out, you know, and that was what took me from, you know, the failed startup in 2010 to being employee 417 at Splunk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and at that point, it was a bake-off between Splunk and Okta, and you saw how both of those companies have gone. Like it was, you know, and this is where I try to educate people because then after that, I selected four companies to work for. Three out of four went through IPO. That was how my investment thesis played out. That mm-hmm. wasn't luck. Right. And I know people that have gone three for three, that have gone to, you know, DocuSign, Snowflake, GitLab, and now are going on to the next ones. And this is what's happening outside of the matrix I'm trying to let people know about is people are doing this. They're not founders. They're, you know, mid-level to experienced executives. And some people are senior or staff engineers and principal engineers, and people are doing this and getting out of the matrix early.
So you bring up a really good point in that these people have crafted a skill and then they've appreciated the value of their own skill. Cause that's sort of what a lot of people miss. It's not like you got lucky. You spent the time primarily, I'm sure, in school and then starting with Accenture to really learn and be able to create something valuable. I think a lot of people miss that in their career. They just think, oh, I just got to go the next step. But once you do create that, then you can create the value that can get equity. That's
Jonathan, you nailed it. You nailed it. Because what people do is they keep thinking, how do I get promoted? And they're thinking about the promotion. They think about the title. But what they don't think about is what I call your career capital. Your career capital is a combination of your education, your experience, and then your results. And you want to make sure that those results, you can quantify those. You can put some numbers behind them. And the more you go around that triangle and you say, okay, I'm going to go take a challenging project and I'm taking my lessons learned from my last project. That's my new education. Then I'm going to go get experience. I'm going to go deliver results. And then I'm going to continue on that triangle. And then what some people do that, the other thing is you also have to make a record. You have to write down, okay, what did I do? What were the results? And be able to tell the story. One of the things that I advocate is that people need to tell their career in the same way that you would tell an exciting story. When I did go and I left Splunk and I went interviewing to see what was my next role, that I ended up landing at Yext, but I went on this crazy tour. I ended up going to Norway. We thought we may go work internationally for a while. And I got all of these amazing interviews, was working with executive recruiters. And it was a very memorable time because I'd honed the skill of storytelling. And I was telling stories of, you know, these key projects at Splunk that were so pivotal. And it was amazing to see these other executives that were on the cusp of IPOs leaning in, wanting to hear, oh, what was, you know, Godfrey Sullivan and Dave Conte and all these execs, wow, this is how they were strategizing and doing all this stuff. But if you can tell a compelling story, that can demonstrate your value, it's huge.
So Christopher, I'd love to pivot because I have a lot of colleagues that are in sales but have been tech sales. So Jonathan, yes, came from UX, you were in consulting, and you got to see how the sausage was made, right? And especially having a very diverse view of things, what works well. Heck, we even found out that you don't even have to work with firms that have to be SOX compliant. If they're in the supply chain of an organization that has to be SOX compliant, you need to help those people out too, because Xerox ain't going to do business with you if you're not SOX compliant as a smaller firm that has an important key part of their supply chain.
That's right.
But a lot of my colleagues in their 30s and 40s and 50s haven't hit it big. One of the first people at LinkedIn before it went public, he made it like a bandit, right? I mean, he was there 4 years prior, but most of my colleagues that might have been a year or two but before that didn't get to retire or didn't get to go two or three of those iterations. And so what would your suggestion be for folks that aren't necessarily directors of engineering or operations or UX that are in the mission critical stage, but rather are that extension that often tend to get a lot of turnover and that wheeled away to that next best thing as things get more challenging, right? So what would your advice be for those folks?
Well, I think number one is it is important that people look for companies, public companies that have a solid value in their equity. Like you look right now, and in regardless of all the layoffs that are happening in Facebook, right, their equity is going up into
the profitability is huge.
The profitability is huge, right? You know that. The reality is there's a lot of companies that are not in the news, right? You think about CrowdStrike has had a great year. Zscaler has had a great year. There's a lot of different companies that are doing well that their stock price is continuing to appreciate, that you can, you know, make a lateral move over there and you can start getting RSUs right away. And I think that the more people, and this is what I try to encourage people to do, is study tech equity, meaning from, you know, from the stock perspective, because I think public companies, because it's already liquid, is a great way to make money. And it's interesting that, you know, going from director and above in those levels, you'll find that there's companies now that are providing liquidity even in the first month. Wow. You know, I've coached some people that, you know, I coached a woman who was at a early stage startup, had, she was a staff level engineer, had a lot of liquidity locked up, and she really wanted to, you know, invest in some short-term rentals. And so we had a conversation and I said, well, you're low risk, low reward. You need to start looking at public companies. She was a little dismayed because, again, the matrix says the only money that's made is in early stage startups. I said, okay, why don't you go get some interviews and let me know what you think? And she went and interviewed with four public companies, and or actually one private, three public, and came back with an offer that matched her salary. You know, so she was making around $250,000 a year. So gave her $250,000 in equity, gave her liquidity in the first month, and at the end of the year, gave her a downside protection. Right. So again, this is an example where while this is an amount of money, she played it conservative because she knew, okay, I can get an extra $250,000 that I can go and invest. Right. Now she ended up landing at this company in 2021. She got all of her RSUs at $21 a share. It ended up shooting up to 61 because she had done a ton of due diligence on the company, saw some momentum that it had, and ended up taking off, you know, $1.7 million off the table that she was able to go invest. But that's also, I also think it's important for people to understand that, you know, and this is where I think it's important for us to talk a little bit about the money, because it's all how it works together that gets us to out of the matrix, is, you know, putting together some $250,000, $500,000, you know, equity years that you can go and continue to invest. Those over time will stack up. If you're investing those correctly, you know, and that can be different for everybody, but if you're going and you're putting that money to work and you're not spending it, over time, you can get to the point where you do have a portfolio of $2, $3, $4 million that can provide you the ability to start living the lifestyle that you want. Now, does that mean giving up work altogether? Maybe not. But does it mean working less? Does it mean owning your own time? I'm sure it does.
Well, I think that's what a lot of people are trying to really understand is the idea of getting out of the matrix is doing what somebody else thinks I should do. And what you're suggesting is this idea of taking responsibility for your journey and crafting it so it works for you. But that end game can be completely different. For some people, it could be 70 hours doing exactly what they love. For some, it could be living on the beach, working 20 hours in contracting. So it's like, how do people begin that journey to really begin crafting something as opposed to operating in the system?
I think it involves discomfort. I hate to be raining on people's parade, but you have to know, like when Neo was at that point and he had to choose the pill and he's taking a pill, he didn't know, excuse me, what was going to happen. And arguably when he went to that ship and he got out of the matrix, he was, his head was hurting. He was really feeling everything. He got out of that slime thing. He was probably feeling horrible. And so I think for many of us, we have to get uncomfortable. I think that finding our way outside of the matrix, you know, I'm a big fan of Naval Ravikant, and he talks about the fact in Naval Ravikant and both, Cal Newport talk about the fact that you're going to find freedom through building skills. You're also going to find your passion through building skills. So I think it's getting uncomfortable and you have to try new things. And I believe that that's somewhere in creation. And it doesn't always mean like a creative job. It can be meaning creating value and helping other people. But that's, to me, is that the way out of the matrix is stay curious, be uncomfortable, and try to develop skills in new areas. This is something I'm so passionate about with my boys. If you're going to pick something, understand what the difference is between a novice and intermediate and advanced, and understand what it means to go through those progressions, because that's ultimately what we're trying to do. I mean, even now, you know, I'm writing a book on, you know, my first book that's going to be published later this year is called From No Dough to IPO, A Proven Playbook for How to Trade Your Time and Talent for Tech Equity. And I am becoming a writer. I've been working on this thing since 2019. I just started, you know, putting everything on paper. And then I started, you know, understanding what does it take to mature as a writer. I could have published this thing, you know, probably a year ago, but I thought, no, I want to actually go and take another writing course and really figure out how do I do this better. Part of that was for the book. I want to deliver quality to people. Part of it was for myself, that I just want to develop and hone my skills with things that I'm passionate about.
Yeah, I'm glad you chose that, because I think a lot of people, well, in fact, if you talk about people blogging or starting a cooking show or writing, people say the way you start writing a book is you start freaking writing the book, right? You have to write in order to get that book done. But I think,
so true.
Just like anything, it's about balance and it's about context and about perspective and the things that you can hone in on, make it a better product than just doing it, right? And I think a lot of people today are content with just throwing random shit out there on TikTok, right? And they're, unfortunately, because I think the IQ levels have dropped significantly in our country and our world, that it's fine, right? It is literally, there's nothing actually contributing mentally to any kind of neocortex development, et cetera. And it's just getting pure views. And I think bringing in a product that, again, is outside of that, right? I don't want to be that next silly dancer or maybe the next, you know, as you're making your meal. Right. How can you create something new and different? So, I mean, Jonathan, you were going to say something, but I was going to say...
I'll dovetail on your point, which is, how do you find something you're really good about or good at that pays you a lot of money that you love doing? That was Jim Collins' triangle of finding what you're really good at that people are willing to pay for is a really hard journey. Because you got, and if you don't love it, it's really hard. So that's how do you help people do that?
I think, well, it's a different journey for everybody, but I think it's encouragement. I think you need to encourage people to keep going, because we're all going to try and we're all going to fail. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, I know for myself, I, you know, was trying this technology when I first got there, right? I was working on some databases. I was doing all this coding on PeopleSoft CRMs. And it was a slog and it was painful. And I knew that I liked the technology, but it wasn't there. And this is what I try to tell people is, at some point, technology is going to pivot. You have to look for the pivot, and sometimes you need that negative, I know what I don't want to do. That's a powerful motivator. So when this opportunity came along for myself to join the Salesforce.com practice, and I saw SaaS, and I saw, well, it wasn't at that point, this SMB product wasn't as flexible as some of these older, you know, ERP and CRM softwares.
Yeah.
It wasn't, right? It was all configurable, but I saw the ability that it could have to accelerate businesses forward. And I knew I didn't want that. I was tired of spending nights tuning servers. So I said, I'm going to move in this direction and I'm going to go all in. And I think, you know, getting back to your point, Jonathan, how do I educate other people is you have to encourage them to stay on the journey, because it's...
Yeah, they have to try.
They have to try. And you know, we'll continue to use this analogy of the Matrix, right? When Neo was outside and he was, you know, getting geared up to go and try and unlock his mind to fight in the Matrix, he kept falling flat. He kept getting defeated. And that's going to be our experience. And this is why I tell everyone, I made that post recently that talked about, you know, my luck, and I didn't end up posting it, but I was going to say my superpower is getting punched in the face and getting back up again, because that's truly how you figure out where you want to go, is you're going to take these brutal losses in one way or another. And it's going to be emotional. And you realize at the time, it's not life-threatening, but it was very emotional and you move on from it. But people need to be able to be persistent, and they need encouragement to keep going.
Well, I think one of the things that my mentors have always told me is your most powerful asset is your capacity to sell something, primarily yourself. And what I don't think a lot of people do is they don't practice believing in themselves. They assume someone else will believe in them, and they wait for that opportunity, when in actuality, you've got to believe in yourself, at least in your possibility that you can do something. And then it's an exploration. It's a try. And like you said, you're going to hit a lot of brick walls. My son started a clothing company right out of high school. And he said, Dad, I don't want to go to college. And I said, oh, you want to do the entrepreneurial thing. And he moved to LA to be close to the garment industry. That's where a lot of the activity was. And he crushed it. And then he lost track of it. And he went through this cycle where he had a ton of success. And then he lost that success to the point that he put it away. And I said, okay, what do you want to do with it? And we've been spending the last year saying, listen, the entrepreneurial journey is getting back up every time. You don't have to do the same thing, but it's getting back up.
Yeah. That's how people are wired like that, though. So, I mean, you look at the Steve Jobs of the world, he was creating things that weren't based on feedback. He wanted to be in front of that, right? And he had vision. He had, and he was an asshole. Let's be fair, right? He didn't care oftentimes what people thought. And I think that, you know, your clients, Christopher, are going to have a whole bunch of different things. But at the very, very least, you have to try regardless. You don't have to fail miserably and be on the front news. That's or you right. don't have to be on the precipice of suicide. But you do have to get out there and become uncomfortable and expose yourself to new and different things such that you can fall back on those perspectives and learn how to pivot in the future. I mean, Pandora, do you know how many times the people at Pandora, the music, station, I think 200 times they pitched. This is according to Reid Hoffman, at least. Wow. So, I mean, there's this kind of construct that says you have to believe in yourself, your team, your product, and then it'll come back. And regardless, you'll have a great book to write. You know, if it all doesn't work out, you know, you've got some things to provide to people.
Well, and this is also why I like to go back to, you know, people need to have a framework of what they are building. Like they need to be thinking about building skills, because I know that the more you can see yourself working your skills, practicing, and that will help you build competence, right? Whether that's a hard technical skill and you see yourself solving problems, or whether that goes to what Jonathan's saying, where it's, you know, selling yourself, right? And I think I do want to touch on that for a moment, because I think some people, they feel it's slimy. And I think selling yourself is slimy when you're not telling the truth.
Yes.
It's true. It's true. When you're not telling the truth. If you think about it, you know, and the way I message to myself is I'm marketing myself. I'm letting people know about me, what's going on, because I believe that marketing is opening a relationship. Yeah. I want to start an ongoing relationship with you, because I think SaaS changed everything. SaaS went from, I mean, in the old ERP days, guys would sell you this software, drop off this whole can of disks, and then they're out of there, right? There's the support guys. Yeah. But now, right, the SaaS teams, right, they're, when it comes to technology, like they're your partners. Right. And this, and technology is now about partners. There's a lot of, you know, service oriented things. So I think that today we need to make sure that we're clear. Marketing is opening a relationship, and that we're not selling ourselves. We're trying to let people know, you know, what's the value that we can bring to them.
So I want to shift gears real quick, because this is your career has gone through consulting and then a ton of really incredible IT projects, but then you shifted gears and you switched into private equity. I want to get to tech news, but I want to start with the private equity part.
Sure.
Because you didn't go back into software tech. Why? I'm curious.
Well, what happened is, my three IPOs were Splunk, Yext, and then I had a miss at Forcepoint, which was a cybersecurity company, and then there's GitLab. And what happened is I was on this personal journey of investing at the same time. And what happened is when I went through my first IPO, I thought that at that point, because I'd had this, you know, multiple seven-figure exit, I thought the doors were going to open and these family offices were going to be around. And when the guys came calling from Morgan Stanley and I realized they were just fast food wealth managers, I was pissed. I was like, what the bleep? I had the ability or the privilege to call a buddy of mine who we'd gotten our computer science degrees together from UC San Diego. And while I stayed in tech, he ended up going back to Wharton for a business MBA and then went into iBanking for years and was running a private family office down in LA. And so I called him up and I go, Marco, like, what's going on? How do I start getting into commercial real estate? How do I start doing this stuff? And he broke down everything for me. And that got myself and my wife on this journey of getting into private equity. Now, you know, the 2-minute drill on private equity is private equity until 2012 was private. When I mean private, it meant that the only way that we could get a deal done is if we had a pre-existing relationship for a minimum of 30 days, then you can tell me about your offering and then I can go invest, and I needed to be accredited. Now, at that point in time, I would self-declare it, but that's a whole other deal. It was 2012, the Jobs Act, that was really intended for a lot of VC investing, that created these 506 C Charlie offerings, meaning that you can pitch online to accredited investors, but you have to have third-party verification that they're accredited. It also opened up all of this commercial real estate stuff that you see out online today, but that it's not really that long ago. So as I went on this journey and I said, and I just started applying my Accenture skills, and that was at that point I took my career and I said, okay, I'm not climbing my career. I'm actually focusing on being excellent in my day job and building out my family's portfolio, that I wanted to have real income. And when I mean income, I mean 10% cash on cash return. So you have $1 million, you're going to get $100,000 a year off of that. And it's also that million is also growing to 1.2, 1.3 million, you know, slowly over time. And as I was doing that, I wouldn't shut up about it. I would kept telling some of my buddies in the Bay Area, and by that time I'd moved here to Austin, and they said, okay, put a deal together for us. I said, well, whoa. I said, I can tell you, I can introduce you to the guy. We don't know the guy. We know you. We know how crazy you are with all the spreadsheets, the numbers, and you know all this stuff. Put a deal together for us. So I started to help my friends out. And it just started to snowball. Then they wouldn't shut up about it. So then other people came. And so it was this golden age of multifamily. So we were investing together in multifamily here in Central Texas.
Austin has been on fire. That triangle even, right?
Where yeah.
And it's exactly. San Antonio.
It's yeah, it's Dallas, San Antonio, and Austin. Yeah.
Wow.
And so then I started following the cash flow. I got in private equity. We got into some automated teller machine funds. We got into mobile home parks. And now we're even in some small businesses, QSR funds, quick service restaurants. You know, but all of this was to create this other side of our portfolio, because everybody has the tech equity, everybody has the index funds, but where do you actually have something that is actually sending tangible checks? Mm-hmm. Right. And you're right, a different class of assets. So then when all of a sudden the market's depressed, well, okay, these valuations are going up. It really does balance out the portfolio. And so that's how I built that private equity company.
But my question was, why didn't you ever go back into tech from an investment standpoint? Because a lot of people who go the IPO route or the acquisition route, and they're flush with cash, turn around and do what they've always been doing, only creating a new offer or investing in a new offer. But you chose real estate. Was that because you had just been doing it and you didn't see any good ideas? Or because perhaps
was it Marco that had that help, that little pivot for you from your colleague at UCSD?
Oh yeah. So let's take a step, because I talk a lot about the private equity, but I literally just released a podcast episode on my portfolio strategy. And my portfolio strategy is a variant of the classic 60-40, which I call the 50-50, which is I do actually have 50% of my holdings is in what I call growth vehicles, which, you know, the low risk is going to be your index funds, your low load funds, high diversification. Then I do own single stocks. I actually do have, right now we have 3 positions in some seed startups. I like doing seed rounds. I like doing some of the direct investing there, just because I love the relationships But that's something that we do. And then it's the other half. Got it. I just spend more time talking about that because that's what people don't know about. And that's what they tend to be curious about. And honestly, that's where I'm trying to educate people because I believe, you know, so let's talk about another matrix here. Mm-hmm. We're matrix talking. I believe that, and data says this, so this isn't just a personal belief, but I'd say follow the data trail, follow my white rabbit. I'm gonna show you guys right now. Before 2008, everybody talked about the 60-40 portfolio with traditional investments, meaning stocks and bonds. You have, you know, this 60% in growth, you have 40% in income, and then as you start aging to 50 and above, that should be 50-50 and start reversing, et cetera. So you have this income portfolio. That was when the bond market was producing, you know, 8, 10%, maybe 12 or 14% if you're getting into what we classified as junk bonds, you know, cash on cash return. So you had something that was there. After the market crash of 2008 and the bottom fell out of the bond market, what happened? Well, in the matrix, what happened is they started saying, oh, you don't need income anymore. Actually, if you have this growth portfolio, it's 100% growth, maybe a little bit of bonds, but then there's this 4% rule. And the thing that I kept asking myself, so you asked, you know, in the IPO, like, why didn't I keep going back into venture and doing this? Because I saw people in the matrix. I've seen people go make a boatload of money and lose it all because going to venture is basically saying, I'm going to go to deploy capital in high risk, high reward growth that's illiquid. Mm-hmm. That's brutal. And I've literally had guys call me up, you know, incredibly upset because they've lost a ton of money doing that because they thought their best thinking got them there. That's what they'll do. Versus, and this is to me is part of the matrix where it says you can, you know, live and retire off of all growth by these very marginal distributions. And the math just never added up for me. And then as you asked questions, you said, well, wait, if I go to Tiger 21, which is a you can go to Tiger 21, the website, it's a group, it's a private group where everyone has a net worth of $10 million and above, and they invest together. You can download their quarterly asset allocations. And if you download their asset allocations of how they as a group invest, what you will find is that if you roughly chopped it into quarters, it's like the 50-50 portfolio, right? It is in the sense, and they usually have 24% is going to be in public equities. That the other half, their income side is going to be in private equities, like businesses that they own. And then the rest is going to be real estate. And then the rest is going to be sort of mixed high risk, you know, cash and some other things. And so it was that. Again, that journey of getting out of the matrix that I realized, oh, got it. Everyone is trapped inside of this 4%. I'm going to fire and get all these index funds. And I said, no, outside the matrix is actually going into private equity. And that's ultimately what I'm trying to do with my platforms is educate technology employees who many are, you know, one percenters, whatever you want to call them. They're making tremendous amounts of money and saying, okay, start on this journey of managing your career well and managing your wealth well and actually build this financial fortress outside of your job that has income that you can then eventually let that be your life business.
Christopher, how would you, one of the things I don't know if we totally covered, but I wanted to be very specific was how does someone go from working primarily on salary to begin engaging the idea and actually doing it to say, no, I'm getting equity? Because a lot of people don't even understand they can do that. How does one make that bridge?
Well, I'd say go and study. There's a couple of sites. So levels.fyi. There's also teamblind.com. But go and see what equity packages look like. Because equity packages are going to be a percentage of cash, a percentage of equity, and depending on your level, sometimes a bonus. Mm-hmm. And when you go to private companies, depending on how early they are, you can, they generally speaking want to hold on to cash. So if you actually don't need cash, you can actually have a conversation and negotiate for equity. Mm-hmm. Now, the more you go from private to more mature private to okay, we're actually, you know, and I'd say, you know, you think about like B round and above, they're probably,
Yeah,
I'd say B and above, they're probably going to have like an HR department. They're probably going to have some frameworks. There's probably some room for negotiation. But the way that I look at it is there's a couple things. If you also understand how comp packages work, meaning I worked 2 years at GitLab, but I took 3 years worth of equity off the table. Well, how is that? Well, because after I was there for a year, they started doing refreshes. They started, you know, they started layering on these golden handcuffs because they knew they were going to go through an IPO. So I got an additional years of equity. So my strategy is always, I look at companies as I'm going to give 2 years and then I'm going to evaluate where we are. And again, my goal was always to find companies that are 18 to 24 months from an IPO. So am I at the IPO? Am I close to the IPO or not? I negotiate for my equity up front. Then I see after 2 years where we are. We'd gone through the IPO. I had been able to then harvest the other equity. At that point, I knew I was ready because I also had a, you know, clear financial plan. But I think people need to study equity compensation packages. And I say that like just, you know, get smart, understand what they are. And then they also need to look at the spectrum of, you know, high risk companies and low risk companies. Low risk, meaning if you go to work for a Google, I mean, just for examples, there's other companies out there, but you go to work for an Apple, Google, Facebook, that company's stock has a value, is floating on the market. You can see what that is, and you can be a part of that.
For you, or for the people that you'd work with, does it really matter if you're in the ISO stage versus RSU? Obviously, the RSO is different. And Jonathan, you're familiar with this, right? So ISOs are individual stock options that are typically 2 to 4 years beyond the IPO that are actually, you have actual strike price. Remember the old stock option days where you'd get stock options and you'd vest a certain amount and then you'd have the option to buy them or the company would help you with that. And in the case of RSUs, you're actually just granted them. So you're given a percentage.
That's right.
300 shares over 3 years, 100 shares a year, 25 a quarter. And then you're taxed on that as ordinary income, but you keep the shares, but you're taxed on that as ordinary income instead of seeing that huge gap there. Is there any difference in the strategy you'd provide for people there, either of those scenarios?
Yes. So ISOs, you have a lot more flexibility in strategy when it comes to taxes. So one of the biggest problems that I see, and this is again a matrix lens that I see people have, is there's a lot of people who work for equity that don't value it. They treat it as, oh, I got this equity thing, this little toy over here. I mean, this is part of where I'm trying to get people to wake up and see this has a value. And actually, if you're choosing the best companies, it has a phenomenal value. So ISOs, you want to manage them up front. As soon as you get them, you need to understand, and this is what I tell everyone is there's the 5T methodology where you need to understand what are the terms. You want to read your stock agreement. You also want to understand the taxonomy. What does all this mean? You need to understand the timing. When do you actually get access to this? What does that mean? Put this out in an inventory. Then you need to understand the taxes. Mm-hmm. And when you look at across all of those different things, ISOs are incredibly flexible because you can actually purchase them and you don't have to pay tax till the next year. So they have the most flexibility. And one of the things that I advise is the first member people should have on their team is a certified tax planner, not a CPA. CPAs are very much akin to a CSI, crime scene investigator when they walk in and they draw a chalk outline along the body, right? CPAs say things like, oh, here's what you owe. You made too much money this year. A certified tax planner says things like, oh, the tax code is actually a book of incentives. If you follow what it says, you'll pay less taxes. A tax planner says, we're going to start now. I'm working right now on my 2024 taxes. I finished my 2023 already. I'm working on my 2024. What moves am I going to make this year so that I can incrementally pay less every year? Those people pay dividends over time. But I think understanding your stock, how it's treated is so important. And creating a tax strategy for yourself is critical.
Christopher, you identified companies that are going public in 18 to 24 months. How do you identify those?
Well, here's one of the things that I use, and I just I did an interview recently with an executive recruiter. So one of the strategies that I use, so there's a few strategies that you can use. One of them is you can figure out, there's usually executives that are pegged that are going to come in or going to take over from a CFO perspective, you know, chief financial officer, chief revenue officer. There's usually some switch in one of those roles before a company is going to get ready to accelerate. And you'll see that happen 9 times out of 10. So the way that I position myself in a few ways, and I look for those companies ready to go for an IPO in a few ways. Number one is you can read Forge Global, which is a big aggregator of tech stocks on a secondary market. They have a prime list of companies that are ready to go. You can also, you know, just see what's out there in the news. The other thing you can do is be watching different companies that are generally around $150 to $200 million in revenue. They have, you know, a good 50 to 75% year-over-year growth or more, you know, things that are growing really fast. That those are the types of companies that people want to get out there. You have a product that people can't stop talking about that they absolutely love. You know, those are really
Round C and Later, definitely. Would you also say? Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. Round C and Later, right? You're seeing they're going to have some more funding. And the companies that you can find that like are like a lower round, like a C or a D or a B, and they're having a lot of traction. Those are the ideal companies because, you know, they probably don't have a lot of dilution. But there's a lot of signs. And this is where I think it's also, how do you strategically position yourself? I've seen people that get on the teams of some of these CFOs, right? Dave Conte, when he came to be the public CFO of Splunk, he brought over with him a few people from other companies that he cherry picked. That then when he went over to Databricks, there were people there that he then chose and they went with him as well. They crushed it at Splunk. Databricks is on track to go out. Now, obviously they had to, you know, take a down round, but I think they're also very well positioned for some good upside. But that's, you know, getting on a team. I know a lot of people that we worked together at Splunk. They went over and you know, built the company Cribble. And so now you see a lot of Splunkers going to Cribble. I think Cribble has tremendous growth and is going to either get to an acquisition or go to an IPO. But again, you see people, that was a team that sort of stuck together. And there's that. The thing that the strategy that I used was this positioning of, I'm the guy who helps you get your business applications ready to go through an IPO. And so, and then I align myself with executive recruiters, and I think it's so important. People don't understand executive recruiters enough that they don't charge you anything. They want to get to know you and they want to help you grow your career so that they can place you. And right. I had 3 executive recruiters in my network. I still even get occasionally inbound today, even though I've been officially off the books since August 2022. But these people would then bring me the deals that I wanted to look at, right? Because I'm an investor and I think about this as deals. They're going to say, oh, we have this company that has this amount of traction, wants to go, and they know that you're the, you know, SOX compliance guy. That's how the GitLab thing just walked in the front door, did the due diligence, saw a lot of signals, who was working there, got all the back channels. And then I saw Godfrey Sullivan, who was my CEO at Splunk, join the board. I'm like, okay, this thing's going to pop. Let's go.
Christopher, one of the things that you're focusing pretty extensively on now is tech careers and money news. So, or money talk. Give us a sense of what you're doing with that so our listeners can kind of tap into that and what you're really trying to accomplish.
I am trying to give people the roadmap out of the matrix. It's not a pill, unfortunately. I wish it was combined into a pill. You take it, superpowers. We download it like we did Morpheus, you know, but it doesn't work.
A lot of work. Hey, if you knew what happens on the other side of that pill, it's involving pain, suffering, puking, realizing where the hell you are, and wanting to get past that. Right? There is a lot of pain and suffering that happened after.
There is.
It's not a magic bullet. That's for sure.
Yeah, and so I have these four pillars that I'm trying to educate people through. The first one is your expertise. You know, how do you build skills, how do you actually talk about skills and build expertise? And then there's the equity component. How do you trade your time and talent for equity? All these strategies that I've been sharing with yourselves, I try to break those down, deep dive into those so that people can pick those up and use them. I did not have, like, I was so obsessed because I knew that there was a freaking matrix. Like, I knew there were people outside the matrix. I had to go find them. I was in the club looking for the white rabbits, you know what I mean? Chased a couple of black squirrels, but I found those dang white rabbits and I figured it out. But it's expertise, equity, then this evergreen portfolio. Then there's the exit plan. And the exit plan is really a combination of your career plan and a financial plan for where you want to go. And I share with everyone, I have an exit plan of where I want to go. I'm now on a 5-year plan, 5 to 7 year plan, where I'm moving out of my private equity business from a general partner. And I'm just doing the education and speaking and writing full time, where, you know, that just makes my heart sing. And I want to just transition out of that. I want to exit from this phase to the next, because I believe that, you know, that our careers can continue to go on in multiple different directions where we're leveraging skills and having fun serving people.
Well, that's just another great medium. That book could, I mean, you're like expanding your reach, right? You're taking the knowledge, the experience, the ups and the downs, you're moving it from one medium to another, and you're looking for expanded reach. And I think it's fascinating, and maybe we'll see it on Audible and get it. Yes. And get an autographed copy.
Yes, sir.
One of the things that I was thinking about, because it's in a lot of people's mind, I think we just didn't, Travis just send you an article today, Jonathan, that talked about Bill Gates dropping a lot of stock, Bezos, divesting a lot of money. There's a lot of concern on the horizon.
Bezos.
Bezos.
Yeah, they've all dumped like 10 to 20% of their portfolio.
Yeah. So give us, in light of continued growth, and there's a lot of great organizations that are going to be valuable and viable, but there's kind of potential headwinds coming up ahead. What do you think in that regard?
What I think in that regard is everybody's focusing on these big, there's these big seven companies, right? You know, mm-hmm. the Amazon, I mean, Microsoft's up there too, that are pulling us forward. And there's a couple comments. Number one is, as these companies have grown over time, it is normal for billionaires to divest too. They have so much of their holdings inside of that company. Divesting to say, I want to, you know, start something else. I believe Bezos does want to go and take some money and start something else. Bill Gates, I don't know if he wants to do something philanthropic, or he's just, this is part of his whole wind down, give it all away strategy. So I think it's important to take that with a grain of salt. And then I think that in the matrix, we get fed so much of just these headline companies that, you know, I'm working with a guy right now to produce an article that really is looking at some of the other segments of tech that have just been sort of slowly growing up and to the right, no noise. You know, so one of them is, we've been looking at some, you know, public mid-size cybersecurity companies. Cyber's going, cyber's always going to be around. You know, you obviously have now these rocket ship AI companies, not a lot of those public. And that's, I think, happening in the private market is interesting, but you also have, you know, some other B&B companies that are just slow, steady eddies that are just continuing to grow. And this is where, when you think like an investor with your time and talent, like all other investors, you know that you're going to have to look beyond the headlines and look at the broad market and go, what's really out there? And this is one of the things I try to encourage people to do in the public markets and also the private markets, is stay curious, ask the questions. Why are they just talking about those companies? Aren't there more companies? Yeah, there's a lot more. You know, the overall tech market, the market for tech employees is continuing to grow. I mean, we still have a deficit in cybersecurity jobs. 100%. We cannot fill all those jobs. And then you think now what's happening with all the machine learning and AI, now there's a huge need, you know, for jobs and things over there. So the need for tech employees is absolutely growing. And I think that after time, there is going to be these larger companies that can't be as nimble, though something will continue to happen to those companies. and then other ones are going to come up to take their place. I think that to me is where your eyes are. And this is what I tell people, you know, they ask me, you know, you asked me the question earlier, Jonathan, it's like, oh, why don't you go do this tech stuff? Well, while nobody was looking, I went and built this big private equity portfolio in multifamily here in Texas, doing all these things that people wish they would have gotten in at the price point we got in on, because I want to look where other people aren't. I want to say, okay, if this is where I see the matrix is heading, I want to boop, take my pill, go outside the matrix and go do that over there. I think it's the same thing with the tech industry.
You're on mute, Jonathan.
I'll cut that out. We have time for about two more questions, and I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned you have two boys. I have
three boys.
Three boys. So I have six kids, and they're all now launched and from a blended marriage. But I'm working intentionally with my son, and I'm imagining you're doing the same thing with your kids. What do you tell them for this emerging generation? What is the smart strategy at their age that you would give to my son and your son for our listeners?
It's not going to be any different than some of the things I already said, which and I can add on to it, but it's focus on building skills. What are the skills that you want to build, and understand what it means to have mastery? We all love to watch the highlight reels of the guys catching the touchdown, doing this stuff, but I want my boys to take this hard look at what happens behind the scenes. And so it is important that, you know, my boys, I have a 11-year-old and 2 9-year-olds, but this is one of the reasons that I stepped away. You know, the pinnacle of my career is because I wanted to now have my lifestyle where I'm not bound to an office or anybody else. I'm designing my lifestyle because I want to walk these guys to manhood. And I want to really put these things into them, which is, you know, build skills, be persistent, you know, life, you know, our mantra is Nelsons do hard things. Like, let's just make that the norm, that we do difficult things. Focus on how do you balance your consumption versus your creation, right? I love going in there. And I mean, we went on Saturdays, man, boo, playing the video games. Okay, great. Now we're going to go play Dixit, which is a story game where you have to create and tell stories, you know, in the evening. So we'll make sure that we balance our consumption with creation. And then just focus on real life and focus on real relationships. I mean, I think that's where we're raising our boys trilingual, and we are spending time, you know, we'll go this summer to, you know, Spain and France and really get into small town culture over there and really try to immerse ourselves. We went to Uganda in November to teach them about water poverty. But I want to show them that there's a big world, and it's meant to be, you know, lived on site, not in the matrix, not through the machine. The other thing we did is we got them, you know, when they were younger, we got them about 4 years ago, we got them 30 chickens was their business. It's like, okay, you want money, then you guys are going to raise and sell eggs. And so we sort of funded, created this business for them. But they learned what it was like to manage employees, their chickens, that, and, you know, there's a lot of, you know, poop and feathers and stuff involved, but they were able to then, you know, create a good product. They had customers right at their school in the neighborhood that they sold to. They managed, you know, to continue the business through 2020, figured out a way to navigate that. And then they're able to then manage their own money, right? They do P&L statements. Okay, here's what we produced. I cut them the cash, and then they have their pocket money. And when they run out, they know they're out.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Out of curiosity, so if you've got them doing chickens, I was going to ask, this is not my question for you, but I was going to say, I've been told that one of the sad things about our country is that the reason we don't speak multiple languages is because we didn't learn it when we were in 5, 6, 7 years old. All these people were immersed in it. And there's something that happens in our physiology that makes it a lot easier to learn a foreign language when your vocal cords aren't fully developed and you've got that more creative side. So how old are they, and how's the language aptitude coming along?
So, yeah. So one of the things I did when I was working in Accenture is when I went and traveled Europe, so this is one of the things that you'll learn about me too, is that maybe I hold grudges. I don't know what it was, but when I was there in Europe, I didn't speak a foreign language. And this was in the 90s. And they told this joke. And I remember I was at this hostel in Paris. What do you call somebody who speaks three languages trilingual? What do you call somebody who speaks two languages? Bilingual. What do you call somebody who speaks one language? And at that point, they all turn to me and they go, American. And I was like, what? What? Yeah. So then when I graduated from college, I ended up and I started going down to Argentina and taking immersion courses. And I said, I'm going to be bilingual and I'm going to teach my kids to be bilingual because of this dang joke, right? Because I'm like, I'm never, anyway. And so the amazing thing is one of the things we found moving to Austin is there is Austin International School is trilingual. And so these guys are fluent, like these guys right now. In fact, my oldest son, I mean, he's helping me hone my Spanish because his skills have now eclipsed mine. And what better way for me to stay fresh than I, you know, when I pick him up from school, like we're chatting in Spanish the whole way home. My wife, who I married, is a Francophone. So that's how we brought in the French. And so, yeah, so we speak multiple languages in the home too.
I love that. Maybe you've already answered the question. My question was going to be, what do you tell your 20, 22-year-old self to help that person out moving, like knowing what you know now, what do you tell your 20-year-old self or 22-year-old self, let's say?
Well, I would say get educated on the private equity. I definitely, the one thing that, and it's not a regret, but I just realized if I could have accelerated that, that could have changed things a lot sooner. Just this exposure and understanding of private equity was huge for me. And then I would have told myself, don't be afraid to write. I had so many ideas and we talked about this a little earlier, Rich, but for so many years I had all these ideas and I kept imagining what it meant to be a writer, but ultimately it was just get up every day and write for an hour. Just get up every day and write for an hour and just write. And the next thing you know, you're a writer. And sure, there's education, there's things to make you a better writer. But if you want to just start writing and getting ideas out on the page, just start writing. Yeah. And that was something that, yeah, took me a minute.
So in a previous career, I had a publishing company and we published 37 books through the process. And it's hard for people to turn off the editor. They'll write one sentence and they go, this is garbage. And that's what I always told them. Turn off that editor and practice vomiting.
Yeah.
Learn how to do rather than critique. And because we're really good at critiquing our own work. And because the writing process is an alchemy of soup that is, it's a recipe that's super hard, but once you get it, it's magical. But it requires first turning that editor off so that you can get to the point where you are. Has your journey as a writer been like that?
Oh yeah, it has. And I was trying to think of, I read this, I can't remember what book I read, but it was one of those books, and there's a style of writing, I think you'll probably know what this is, Jonathan, where you try and write as fast as you think, and there's no editing involved.
Yes.
And you just try and go and get everything down, and then you step away and then you come back for an editing session. And so I definitely found, people ask about, what was it like, writing? It's just, it was lonely and painful. But I also felt like I had to process some stuff. I wanted to so badly get some of these ideas out on the page. I wanted to help people get out of the matrix. And then once you start adding a little skill, I think like anything else, you're going to be frustrated. Then you start adding a little skill. Now I enjoy it. Now I sit down and I love, writing, and I'm excited to, I'm actually trying to add some more conceptual diagrams to some of the things I'm writing. It's not the words that are holding me up, but I'm trying to add a few pictures and evolve myself in that way. But at this point I'm sitting on, I have 2.5 manuscripts already done.
That's awesome. Yeah. So Christopher, this has been an absolute, I love when we get to dive into this stuff because this is so wonderful. How do people find you, especially your podcast and your tech careers and money talk?
Yeah. Yeah. So I have two products and they're all free, but I have Tech Careers and Money Talk is my podcast. If you go to techcareersandmoneytalk.com, you can go there, see the back catalog. You can also go to YouTube. We have a YouTube channel if you want to see the videos. And then we have Tech Careers and Money News is my weekly newsletter where I usually take the things that we talk about in the podcast. And I give you that cheat sheet. Okay, what is that? So we went and talked to an executive recruiter last week. If you go to then the Tech Career Money News, you're going to see, okay, what are the things I need to do to engage with a executive recruiter? What are the values that they can bring to the table and other things? So those are the two things I'm leveraging right now to help get people outside of the matrix.
Awesome.
I love it.
So, Christopher, thank you. This has been absolutely wonderful. I would love to have you back. To all of our listeners, this has been an absolute wonderful episode. Please review, comment, and let us know what you think. If you have someone you'd like us to invite, please let us know and introduce us, because we've had some absolutely amazing guests this year so far, and we want to keep that going. So to all of our listeners, have an awesome week, and much love, everybody. Thank you.